underneath the concrete jungle of Kalamazoo. Anarchy on the airway. The People's Power Hour on 89.1 WIDR.
Now, he's a spoiled brat. Tried the nice guy who replaced him, cooperating with the president.
We are speaking with David Graeber. David is an author, an activist, an anthropologist, and an anarchist. And until very recently, he was also a professor at Yale. And we perhaps know him best as our correspondent to the RNC here at the People's Power Hour. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Actually, you know, I'm still a professor at Yale as of, they can't really get rid of me for another year.
Okay, so well, fill us in on that. What happened to you at Yale?
Well, you know, it's really hard to say exactly because Yale is very secretive. What happened was, normally the way it works at Yale, you have 6 years as an assistant professor, and then they bump you up to this term associate. This kind of weird thing that only exists at Yale, where it's associate without tenure, and then you come up for tenure and you never get it. Like about 3% of faculty end up getting tenure. And somehow or other, people tried to block my promotion to term associate and weren't really able to do so. And just this year, I was up for review, because you're come up for review the year, penultimate year of your contract. They blocked it so far as they gave me 2 years instead of four, told me I wasn't reliable, which was kind of peculiar since they'd never asked me to do anything before. And this year I came up for review and they decided to kick me out. Didn't give me any reason whatsoever.
What was the official reason?
None. They didn't give me any reason whatsoever. It's kind of odd, isn't it?
Well, why do you think that you were fired?
Well, you know, since everything about the meetings is completely secret, I'm not allowed to know. Let's put it this way. First 3 years I was there, they thought I was just great. I had a 3-year review. I passed it just fine. After that, I became involved in the global justice movement, and then I started getting quoted in the papers as a spokesman for anarchist groups. And then all of a sudden, they found all these little things that bothered them, like, you know, I come late to class, they claimed, or they started saying that, like, I turn in my grades late, which is odd, because I don't actually turn in my grades late, but since it's all said in secret rooms where I'm not actually supposed to know what the accusation is, then there wasn't really a way to point that out. And, you know, they basically nickeled and dimed me and came up with all these little things. And some of them were determined to kick me out. Others thought they were insane. It went, I think, to the dean, who told them that you can't actually kick somebody out without giving them any kind of warning. So they gave me a warning saying, you know, stop beating your wife, basically, you know. Be more reliable. And then this year, and so I actually took them seriously. I thought they meant, well, you know, do more service work. So I organized a colloquium series and I did all this work for the department, and then all of a sudden I was gone. Actually, the real reason seems to be, I mean, I kind of discovered what they meant by reliable about halfway through the term. You see, at Yale, the real issue for a lot of these people is the graduate student unionization. It's a group called GSO, the Graduate Employees and Students Organization, and the department's very divided. Between pro-GSO and anti-GSO students, and some of the senior faculty are just obsessed. They hate the union. It's not clear exactly why. I mean, these people are supposed to be anthropologists, you know, I mean, who can kind of deal with different types of organization, and they're all think of themselves as progressives, but, you know, they're that strange breed that are progressive about anything except anything affecting their own life, in which case they become strangely reactionary. At any rate, all of a sudden, one of the faculty members decided to try to kick out one of the chief graduate student organizers, who's a very brilliant student, actually, on clearly bogus grounds. So I was the only person willing to stand up for her when they asked her to leave. You know, and we got her through, but it looks like then they came gunning after me. I mean, that's what the union thinks, so they're backing me up very strongly on this.
So you think that the most likely reason is that you supported the Graduate Students Union?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, that's what in academics, I said this a lot of times. You know, they don't really care what your politics are as long as you're willing to be a hypocrite about them. You know, as long as you know, you could say anything you like as long as it affects what your practice in no way. You know, some place like Yale is more extreme, but any university, it's basically a medieval social structure. I often say that you know, there's only three institutions that have survived more or less intact from the High Middle Ages: the Roman Catholic Church, the British monarchy, and the university system. It's totally structured the same way it was in, you know, 13th century. Extremely hierarchical. And if you go along with that, well, you know, you can pretty much state any opinion you want, but the moment you challenge people's power within the university, they just go crazy. And it's very hard to be an anarchist without doing that in some way. I mean, even just treat people like equals, you know, it gets people annoyed who consider themselves superiors.
Well, you've said that.
And in this case, the graduate unionization issue just drives them crazy. They just hate the union, some of these people. So they figured he's a radical, he must be one of those GISO people. And they kind of put me to the test as the best way that I mean, I don't really know, right? It's all guesswork. They all stopped speaking to me 3 years ago when I became involved in the global justice movement. But I...
Oh. All right. We've got a little technical difficulty there. Hold on. We'll be back here with David Graeber in just a minute. And we're back with David Graeber. You're listening to your source, 89.1 WIDR-FM.
David, do you think that Yale had a hand in that?
Yale, in what sense?
In cutting off your phone.
Oh, the phone. Actually, no, I think that it pulled out of the wall. But, sorry about this, it's kind of my fault. But at any rate, yeah, where was I up to? I was explaining what happened. It's strange. I think I said they gave me this letter saying, you know, you're not reliable. Work on your reliability. And I thought, that's weird. Nobody ever asked me to do anything around here. What do they mean? And I guess I kind of found out. It almost felt like it was a loyalty test. You know, here we're going to do something that's completely obnoxious and insane, and are you going to go along with it? So there was this student who, as I say, really interesting, innovative student, great project. And her advisor, who has this notorious history of suddenly turning on people who always seem to be part of the union, suddenly decided she had a bad project, and she was going to write her a letter saying her project was bad, or write a letter of recommendation saying it wasn't any good. So, you know, obviously no one's going to send a letter like that. So she didn't send the letter, and then the person accused her of ethical violations for not sending the letter and wanted to kick her out. And I was the only person who just was willing to stand up at the meeting and say, but this is insane. You know, this is a good student. I'm sure there's some way we can salvage this. And just for doing that, it seemed to have spelled my doom, you know. With the intervention of the union, we managed to get her through, and she's fine, but, you know, then they came after me.
So now we've been hearing a lot about the graduate student union, and I know this has been happening at several of the Ivy League universities, too. Is that connected to that movement right now of these student teachers trying to unionize?
Exactly. That's what we're talking about. GISO is part of it. And this was all right before a major strike. So these are people who are helping to organize the strike, and usually they just want to make an example out of someone. And it's funny, because the person they went after, you know, there's some people that are really strong, kind of in-your-face organizers, and it's almost like the predator instinct. They go after the one that looks weak. So this student, she was kind of sweet and inoffensive and shy, so they figured she must be a weak one. We'll try to terrorize her and drive her out. And they failed. She's fought back, which kind of surprised them. But you know, I got drawn into the middle of it. So in a way, the irony, I mean, just being an anarchist isn't going to get you kicked out of Yale. I mean, I would never have gotten tenure. But you know, finally I got kicked out basically for being a conscientious teacher. I mean, her work was good, and I said so.
Well, so you've said that you can be an anarchist in the academy as long as you're a hypocrite, and that you're allowed to say whatever you want as long as you don't do it on campus. But what about the example of Ward Churchill? I mean, he, you know, was really brought up to the dock for saying something people found offensive.
Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, they can go after you for things you say, and they're starting to change the rules. I think there is an attempt to change the rules going on now. In fact, there's a kind of a pattern. The problem with Ward Churchill is you know, there's something that he said, so you can argue about that. In a way, what they did in my case, and, you know, ultimately it comes down to my being an anarchist, in a lot of other cases now, is they just don't give any reason at all. It's not like I said anything that they can point to, which is anyone would find so deeply offensive that they could make a case I deserve to be fired. And that's been happening. I can't mention names because a lot of these things, people don't really want their names publicized. But I know for a fact, and examples have been coming in, of a lot of people who are anarchists or other types of radicals who just suddenly had their contracts canceled for no reason.
David, you've kind of spoken about this or written about it in interviews that I've seen. You talk about a transition that's going on from the neoliberal university to the imperial university.
One way I thought maybe one could frame it.
Yeah, could you expand on that a little bit, what the change specifically might be?
Well, the way I was thinking was like this. Until recently, as long as you won't challenge the corporatization of the university, you're basically okay. Universities have been increasingly turned into profit-making enterprises. They always were to some degree, but it's become much more explicit. They've been restructured on corporate lines. And that's where the big battle was. And that's why the union was the big issue. As long as you don't challenge that, you were pretty much okay. And, I mean, I pushed it as far as one could because I was doing a lot of very radical things. I just wasn't doing any of them in the same city as I taught in. On the other hand, I think, you know, what we're seeing of all these people suddenly being dropped for it with no explanation, with the Ward Churchill, some of the things going on at Columbia, I mean, what we might be seeing is people trying to change the rules. Now, I don't know if they're going to succeed. There's certainly resistance to it, but I think that they're trying to create a situation where certain types of radicals can be fired just for being radicals. In a way, perhaps my case has become a test case, because for the reason that they gave no reason. One reason I'm fighting it is I don't even really want to stay at Yale that much. I mean, if things change radically there in my department, then maybe so. And the graduate students, you know, certainly want me to fight, and I certainly support them because I think the graduate students are really great, and I don't want to abandon them. But on the other hand, I mean, I'm just fighting because there's a principle here that you can't just drive people out for their politics. If I let this stand, I think I'm not doing a favor to anyone in the country. So the Imperial University, I guess that's all I mean by it, a situation where universities are no longer seen just as or corporations producing knowledge for money, but are now seen more as part of an ideological structure of empire.
I wonder specifically what this transition to a more imperial university might mean for anthropology. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I haven't really been studying the discipline as a whole, but the things that I've heard are kind of disturbing. I mean, more and more that type of knowledge, we're getting back to a kind of situation they had in the 60s. You know, there were a whole series of scandals because in the 60s about anthropologists in particular and social scientists in general, Project Camelot was one of the famous scandals, being involved in these various CIA-funded operations. Because, you know, anthropologists know a lot of stuff which would be very useful to people running imperialistic wars.
Sure.
And since the 60s, there's very much been a decision on the part of almost all the professional organizations that we are just not going to do that anymore. You know, I know people who study Peru or Nepal, been approached all the time by CIA people interested in coming up with formulas for fighting Maoists, and you know, almost all of them are just constantly being asked questions like this by mysterious guys who show up and who don't know who they are, and you know, just assume these guys are CIA. So there's, in general, you know, anthropologists have on principle resisted that kind of thing. On the other hand, anthropologists have been more and more drawn into institutions like the World Bank. So the sort of neoliberal wave has definitely started to encompass anthropologists. There's more and more anthropologists involved in things like advertising, partly because jobs are dry, when jobs dry up in teaching. So the sort of neoliberalization of anthropology is pretty disturbing. whether they'll start cooperating again with even more sketchy imperialist adventurers rather remains to be seen, but there's definitely a pressure right now in order to do so.
So you're speaking as if you understand neoliberalism and imperialism to be two different things, do you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting theoretical question. I think that neoliberalism has to be backed up by something. I think that in the Clinton years, there was a feeling that it didn't. There was, you know, what they called the Washington Consensus. There was a real feeling that there was an ideological hegemony with the fall of the Soviet Union, and that these things didn't have to be imposed by force. I think people started believing their own rhetoric in a certain way when they said that free market capitalism is just natural, and that's just what people will naturally do if left to their own devices. And that really fell apart. And, of course, a lot of the movements that I've been working with, and I'm sure you have too, had a lot to do with that. You know, People's Global Action, all the direct action networks, and anti-capitalist convergences, and so forth and so on, and not to mention the endless organizations in South America, India, of various kinds. I mean, there was a very, very effective international resistance against the neoliberal ideological hegemony, which I think destroyed it much quicker than any of us thought possible. I mean, I remember back in 2000, it's hard to remember from this perspective the way the rhetoric was still, you know, it's just ordinary common sense that sort of neoliberal free market trade policies are the only way anybody could ever possibly do anything and the only possible direction for the world future. And it just took 2 or 3 years for the same people who were treating us as if we were completely insane to say, oh, well, I guess those anti-globalization people were right. So ideologically, as an ideological project, it really fell apart much, much quicker than any of us would have possibly imagined. On the other hand, you know, it is typical of elites that when they get thrown into a panic, which is what happens when their ideological hegemony is shattered, you know, the usual reaction is to start a war. Now, I would say it doesn't really matter that much who the war is against, as long as it's, you know, there's some kind of plausible threat that they can ask people to make some kind of sacrifices. And in a climate of war, then you can do a lot of other things, and the gloves come off, basically. And in a way, Osama bin Laden really saved them, because until that time, it just wasn't clear what that enemy was going to be. They kept trying to come up with ones. No one was really convinced. You know, they tried to talk about international drug cartels, and nobody really thought that they could really have a global war against them. The sudden emergence of Al-Qaeda and groups like that, in a way, really saved them.
So you would say it's partially a victory of the social justice movement that it, you know, acknowledges that the system has now acknowledged that we need to force people to be free.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they were really thrown for a loop. And it would be interesting to know what they would have done had it not been for September 11th. They were in kind of a bind because they couldn't go against us. You know, we just clearly weren't a threat to anyone. They kept trying to represent anarchists as a great threat to civilization, but nobody was buying it. Then suddenly, you know, they have something that they can call a real war on their hands, and everything changes.
We were kind of amused here recently to learn that the FBI said that the top domestic terror threat was, radical environmentalists.
As opposed to like whoever those guys were that were sending out the anthrax, that they never quite figured out who they were.
Sure.
They seemed to have been right-wing crazies instead, right?
Right.
It's kind of amusing, isn't it? But again, in this new climate, maybe they can convince someone of that, but they certainly weren't getting very far in convincing anybody to panic about ELF before this.
Well, so let's turn to the global justice movement. Attendance, at least in North America, at global justice rallies, at least, has really declined. What do you think that is?
Pardon, I didn't catch the end of the question.
Why do you think that is, at least in North America, that attendance at what's called anti-globalization rallies is decreasing?
It's so gone down. Well, I think there's like two different things. I mean, partly there is a huge internal critique against summit hopping, which, I mean, I don't know anybody who isn't even slightly embarrassed to be even accused of being a summit hopping. So partly it was the internal dynamic of the movement. There was this very strong feeling that those huge ceremonial events were sort of self-indulgent and a product of privilege. I'm sure you all know the critique. And that community organizing and rooting yourself in the struggles of particular oppressed groups who are most immediately affected by these larger global processes is the only way to go on these things, which will have a real lasting effect. I mean, personally, I think the critique, obviously, I'm not rejecting the critique, but it seems to me that's not a reason to stop, it's a reason to do both, because the summit hopping actually did have an effect of keeping the movement on the map, which then made it easier to do the community organizing, which that synergy is a little bit lost. But I think largely it's just the atmosphere of repression. I mean, the Miami model and so forth, they just weren't able to get away with that kind of thing earlier. And finally, I think that people have fallen victim to their own success. Again, I think people were thrown for a loop because, you know, we thought we'd be fighting a 10-year war against global neoliberal trade agreements, and instead it all kind of fell apart in two, maybe three. And people have to regear themselves to a very, very different sort of campaign, and a campaign which is much more difficult to fight. I mean, trying to support internationalism in the context of a war mobilization is just notoriously difficult. I mean, look back at what happened in World War I. The entire internationalist movement fell apart, really. And I don't think that's happening on a global scale, but it's not surprising that America, the one country the most paranoid and that feels the most wounded in this whole thing, is, well, of the industrial powers at any rate, is feeling it the most.
David, I was curious. A lot of people are a little confused, I think maybe people that aren't too well informed about anarchism, about how anarchists resist neoliberal policies, yet at the same time, a lot of these demonstrations or activities against neoliberal policies are to defend state services or public property, you know, whether it's public parks or,
mm-hmm.
You know, various state services. How do you reconcile that in your own mind and ideology?
Well, I think a lot of people make a distinction between public or collective forms of property and state property. It happens that under the regime of laws that now exist, the state co-opts everything. Thus, you know, private property is guaranteed by the state as well, but no one thinks of it as state property.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's entailed by the state if the state there. So I think what people are really defending is the principle of collective decision-making and the principle of collective communal services, the principle of community. Now, obviously, as an anarchist, you believe those communities should be self-governing and should be ultimately be free of states if at all possible. And, you know, given a choice between supporting something that's state-funded and something which is autonomous, obviously you're going to support the autonomous option. But it's that principle of commonality, community, people managing their own affairs collectively that we're ultimately talking about. And it happens that, you know, in order to defend that in a lot of contexts, one is somewhat forced into the position of defending things that are currently guaranteed by the state. But that don't always have to be.
I'm kind of curious, too, working at Yale, it being a private institution and you know, a long historic part of the American elite, you know, skull and bones and all that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, just kind of what's your take on that and being so close to this kind of, you know, historic East Coast aristocracy and their culture?
Working for Yale is very funny, actually. I mean, especially the undergraduates, it's fascinating, really, because you teach these classes and it's really kind of interesting because half of the students are just, you know, really smart. I mean, these are some of the smartest people you're ever going to meet. They're creative, they're interesting, they're all kind of quirky in interesting ways, and they're just like, just, you know, they're smarter than the graduate students. They're smarter than you are, half of them. They're just really, really sharp. And then half of them, kind of dumb.
legacy,
you know, sort of like football players, except they don't play football sometimes. George W. Bush types. But, and you wonder about this for a little while. Well, you don't have to wonder very much. It's kind of clear what's going on when you also consider that half of the students at Yale are receiving no form of financial aid, and it costs $30,000 a year, way over, you know, the average income of the average American.
Sure.
But I guess I had this great realization at one point that, yeah, half the students are really brilliant, and half the students are kind of dumb, and you can tell that 15 years from now, all of the really smart ones are going to be working for all the dumb ones. That's how it's going to work, right?
Yeah.
It's a strange thing. I mean, I just figure, look, it's a job, right?
Oh, sure.
You know, if I were working for a company, I'd be in the same position. You know, one has to eat. I have an aged mother that I pay her rent, you know. I come from a working class background. I don't really have the privilege of living any old way that I want to. It's, you know, I got a job for a while working for some people I don't like very much, but a lot of people have been in that situation, and I won't be in it forever.
So what has been the public response to your firing?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it depends on what public you're talking about here, but the students, of course, were just outraged because, well, for one reason, I was one of the teachers, few teachers in the department who really taught them much of anything, but they were just shocked and disturbed, and they immediately started organizing. And of course, that put me in a really difficult position because I spent all this time never doing any organizing on campus. And, you know, I know how to do a lot of this stuff, but of course, I can't be involved, right? Because I'm the innocent victim. You couldn't, I mean, if I were like there telling the students how to run a meeting and guiding these things, that would be a disaster. I mean,
sure.
I can't do that. So I just have to sit back and let them do it. Although, you know, you watch some of it, and these guys have no experience. I mean, they're great. They're very smart. They're really dedicated. But you kind of wish you could say, no, 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 that's not how you do it, guys. But I can't. I just got to sit there and watch. So the students, they've organized. And they've been great. They've been wonderful. They have a web page up. Anybody wants to look, it's www.geocities.com/GraberSolidarity. And it's got a very flattering picture of me and a lot of the things I've written and letters written and pictures of their vain attempts to give the petition to various school officials who pretended they weren't there, you know, stuff like that. And so the students have been great, and they put out a petition. The petition just took off. I mean, it was a pretty amazing. Within a few days, we had thousands of signatures. I think it's up to 3,500 now, maybe 36. And it's growing all the time. So there's a link to the petition on the webpage if anybody wants to sign it. So that took off. And there's people signing in Slovenia. There's people signing in Botswana. You know, it's all over the world. It's kind of fun to watch it go by. You know. And gives you some, you know, because you never get a chance as a scholar to actually know who's actually been reading your stuff and who you've been affecting. And suddenly I know, you know. My very favorite one was somebody who signed gas station attendant and reader of his work. Wow, that's so cool. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers has been very involved in all of this. They've been, like, Canadian postmen are great. I mean, there's been all over this case. They've been writing letters. Lots of scholars have become really upset because I think they see this as a terrible precedent. So we have people sending in letters from all over the world, and anthropologists, like, in the UK in particular, they're really organizing. So far, Glasgow, Manchester, and Sussex, everybody in the entire anthropology department, as far as I can make out, signed collective letters protesting what's going on. There's more coming. Different departments in the U.S. are starting to do the same thing. So there's been a real outpouring, both within the discipline and also from anarchists around the world who are concerned as well.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to have a shout out for Canada Post. Canada Post always comes out in solidarity with students.
Yeah, they're great. Canadian postmen rock. I mean, they're also actually the Canadian Postal Workers Union is, I believe, still the information hub for People's Global Action.
So, if people want to help you, what can they do?
Well, you know, want to sign my petition? That's always nice. If nothing else, it really embarrasses Yale, and there's never any harm in that. Well, when they seem to be trying so hard to embarrass themselves anyway. There's a petition that's on the webpage. Anybody want to read my stuff and give me comments? I appreciate that. Basically, that's it. I mean, obviously, this isn't the kind of thing that people should be rioting in the streets about. There's a lot much more important things to be rioting in the streets about. But I do think that, you know, if you want to sign the petition, it's really kind of nice to know who's out there, who likes this kind of politics, who's interested in the kind of ideas I'm putting out, you know. And in addition to that, you know, well, anybody know of any good jobs anywhere else? Please tell me.
Maybe the Canadian Postman have an opening.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's rumblings, you know. I mean, I've heard things everything from Nanterre and Paris to, you know, places in England are thinking about it, you know. But I don't know if they're being making the offers, but I don't know if they're just being expressive or not.
Good luck getting a job in America right now, because it's not too easy to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I want to stay in America, I think.
Especially here in Michigan, too. Our economy is pretty awful right now. The job scene's not good.
Yeah, I know. It's a problem. The euro's strong. I don't want to end up in Europe, though. I mean, my family's all here.
Well,
so, I guess I could do worse.
Speaking of...
But it's interesting that Europe, they seem sane. You know, I mean, the reaction in Europe has been much greater and much faster and much stronger than it is in the U.S. Maybe it shows the degree to which people really are moving more toward the Imperial University already and are more cowed here in America. In Europe, I mean, I've heard that there's talk of a measure in the European Parliament to support me.
Oh, nice. Speaking of Canada and street actions, in one of your articles you wrote that there was a moment you had at the summit in Quebec that was very important to you.
Oh, the security fence, yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
You want me to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, just what it was like and why it was so important to you. And
oh, well, I thought it was just a brilliant moment. I mean, at Quebec City, there was a lot of... Actually, I have a book coming out about this. I just got a contract for it. The tentative title is Direct Action and Ethnography. And I start out with a kind of story of events leading up to the actions in Quebec City. Which I was involved in various different levels. At that time, there was a Yabasta group in New York, which turned out to be kind of a joke. I mean, we practiced in all the fancy uniforms with the chemical suits and the padding and the helmets. And of course, as it turned out, nobody actually managed to get over the border with any of that stuff. And I was the only person from the group who kind of accidentally got through and ended up in Quebec City. But part of the whole debate before Quebec City was... That was the first action where they came up with the idea of putting a giant fence around a part of the city to keep everybody out of it, which created tactical problems. You couldn't shut down the meeting, so what exactly were you going to do? Were you going to try to, you know, brush the fence and invade? Were you going to just try to go someplace completely different and avoid it? Were you going to try to surround the fence and blockade it? But then what's the point? Because they've already got everything they need inside anyway. It created a big problem. So finally, there was a consensus that the thing to do is simply to remove the fence and then not cross in. Because the fence itself became the best symbol for what neoliberalism really meant. Because, you know, here are these people who represent what they're doing is tearing down borders and walls, but all they do is build them up. I mean, the statistic I always liked was that since NAFTA, the size of the border patrol between America and Mexico has tripled. That was actually a few years ago. I wouldn't be surprised if it's quadrupled by now. And what they're really doing is fortifying all the borders against movements of people so that corporations can move freely and take advantage of the fact that people are desperate and trapped. And the fence, the fact that these world leaders had to, like, put up this gigantic fence in order to insulate themselves from the citizens they claim to represent, to make decisions in their name, you know, it seemed the perfect symbol. We would just tear down the fence. And the very moment where the fence came down was just magnificent, because it just showed the power of, well, the power of just what you can do of direct action. We'd been told for weeks and weeks that this place is going to be the most heavily fortified, this is going to be the largest security operation in Canadian history. They were flying in, you know, these ultra heavily armed Darth Vader type stormtroopers from all over the place. There'd be thousands of them. Don't even try to go near there. And what ended up happening is there were just so many people and they were so determined that the police just vanished. They swept away. It was all we called their bluff and just walked right up to the thing, and everybody immediately started tearing it down. And it was just this amazing mixture of people. There were steel workers, there were Mohawk warriors, there was every conceivable type of people just all joining together and pulling down this fence. And then walking away from it. There wasn't even an attempt to, like, invade. Because the fence itself was a symbol of everything we hated.
And you tore it down to the power of direct action. And Arun Hadi Roy called something like that the opposite of a nuclear bomb.
I didn't remember that one. That's very nice.
People coming together. Well, David, all right, we're going to have to end our interview, but thank you very much for coming on the air today. We appreciated hearing from you, and maybe we'll get back with you in a few months here to get an update on your Yale situation and see how things are going there.
One thing to throw in. You know, sure. You were saying if there's anything that people can do to support, I suggest you go to Scotland if you possibly can. You know, because I think summit hopping, it's got a bad name, I know, but I think we should do it again. I think there's a lot of people going to Scotland for the G8, and it's looking to be very good. It's looking like it's going to be a really inspiring event.
And what's
going to be an attempt
that?
To bring together the anti-imperial and the anti-neoliberal in one package. So I think it's there's going to be a blockade of the Trident nuclear submarine base, for example, at just before the day of actions against the G8 itself. So I think this... The plans I've seen are really inspiring and fun, too. It's going to be a gigantic army of 3,000 clowns, so I hear, trying to rush the summit. So consider doing that.
Putting the fun back in revolution.
Exactly.
All right. What's the date for that, too, David?
Okay. Great to talk to you.
All right, you too. Yep. Thank you very much. And you've got it tuned to your source, 89.1 WIDR.